Our spoken meditation this morning was from Dr. King's powerful letter from a Birmingham jail. If you've never read the full item, the full letter, or haven't read it recently, I encourage you to Google it and spend some time with it. It's based particularly on the teachings of Jesus and Gandhi, and King makes a compelling argument for creating social change, in this case, greater racial equality and greater racial justice through nonviolent direct action. And although I don't have time this morning to go into the specifics, I'd be glad to speak with any of you afterwards or talk about it at length at some point, there is a strong case to be made that following the way of Jesus, who taught lessons such as love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, requires choosing the path of nonviolence over violence. At the very least, loving your enemies should mean not killing them, I would invite you to consider. But as part of my move from progressive Christianity to Unitarian Universalism, I've read a lot of Unitarian Universalist history, which is really fascinating because Unitarians and Universalists have often been on the edge, you know, challenging the status quo and the norm, the usually conceived norm. So it's fascinating to see what that's looked like and how it's manifested at various points in our history. And one of my biggest surprises was learning that the Secret Six who helped fund and supply John Brown's 1859 raid on the Federal Armory at Harper's Ferry, a mere 20 minutes drive from here, I'm sure most of you have probably been there at some point, but I encourage you to go again and look at it through this lens, that five of the Secret Six were Unitarians, two of them were Unitarian ministers. And part of what I would like us to explore this morning is the history of our Unitarian and Universalist predecessors who supported nonviolent activism exclusively, as well as those who supported violence when they felt it was justified. I had originally planned to tell more thickly and descriptively the story of the Secret Six, and I may do that at length at some future point, but I want to do something a little more episodic to give us some things to compare. For example, last week we focused some on Hosea Ballou, who was the leader of the second generation of American Universalists. At the beginning of the War of 1812 with England, President Madison called for a National Day of Prayer in support of the war. Ballou, who seldom spoke out on political matters from the pulpit, nevertheless answered Madison's call with a strong sermon in support of the president's policies. While the majority of the congregation agreed with their minister in this case, the wealthy ship owners in the church, whose businesses had been badly hurt by that war, strongly objected and in time withdrew their support from the congregation. As a result, the church's financial position became so weakened that Ballou was forced to open a private school to provide his family with a second income. So let's not go there, right? That's a let's not repeat that particular mistake of history. But an interesting intersection, right, of church and state, right? And Martin Luther King Jr., of course, famously said, it's not that church and state, that original separation of church and state was about withdrawing financial funding of the government funding the state, such that then the state could threaten the church if it became prophetic. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. said very clearly, the church must be the conscience of the state. So wrestling with what that means, though, is the trick. As a counterexample, Hosea Ballou's distant cousin, Aidan Ballou, published a book in 1846 on Christian non-resistance about his belief in the need to radically follow Jesus' teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. Keep in mind that our Unitarian and Universalist forebears, especially in the 19th century, were deeply tied up in liberal Christianity before the sort of move starting in the early 20th century toward humanism and some of the world religious influences. So Aidan Ballou was looking at things like, do not resist an evildoer. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go a second mile. So Ballou, who was seeking to follow Jesus' way in his time and place, to him this meant committing to nonviolence, even though that had major consequences. Another famous contrast of position on war and peacemaking is the serious conflict that developed in World War I between the Unitarian minister and pacifist John Haynes Holmes and the active Unitarian layperson William Howard Taft. Now, that is the Taft who was President of the United States and later Supreme Court Justice. Holmes was the foremost American interpreter of Gandhi's views. He preached a famous sermon about Gandhi that got a lot of publicity in 1921. Now, that's pretty early in the grand scheme of things. Keep in mind that Martin Luther King Jr., who became another radical interpreter of Gandhi's views, he wasn't born until 8 years later in 1929. So Holmes is working pretty early. Holmes opposed the U.S. involvement in World War I, whereas Taft was a strong supporter of the war. Taft's term as President of the United States ended in 1913, just before World War I started in Europe in 1914. And from 1915 to 1925, former U.S. President Taft became president of the General Conference of the Unitarians and other Christian churches. Again, church and state getting messy. This conflict between Taft and Holmes happened in 1917 as part of the U.S. entering World War I. At that year's Unitarian Conference, Taft publicly declared, "It is the duty of our church to preach the righteousness of the war and the necessity of our winning it in the interest of peace in the world." Holmes dissented publicly, "So long as I live, I will have nothing to do with this war or any war, so help me God." In the end, Taft's resolution to support the war won 236 delegates to 9 delegates supporting Holmes. Furthermore, the board of the American Unitarian Association, in a sort of punitive measure, voted to deny financial aid to any church whose minister was not in support of the war effort. In terms, Holmes said, fine. He withdrew his ministerial fellowship with the American Unitarian Association. One or two other ministers did the same thing and led his congregation in changing their name from the Unitarian Church of the Messiah to the Community Church of New York. After the war, Holmes reconciled with Unitarianism. However, you can see even from these few episodes that there are prominent lines of demarcation in our history supporting nonviolent activism, as well as others supporting violence when deemed justified. Indeed, if you go look at the video that's free online from this past General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association that just recently met in Providence, a strong emphasis in what's called the Service of the Living Tradition this year was on military chaplaincy, which is fine, but it's a very interesting to sort of another episode and note in this history. Decades later, of course, the controversy over whether to support or protest the Vietnam War was a major source of conflict in many of our Unitarian Universalist congregations. I'd be interested to hear from you if any of you were part of Unitarian congregations during the Vietnam War and how that played out in your local congregation. Just this past week, more than 100 religious activists, this was in the Washington Post, including many Unitarian Universalist laity and ministers, were arrested as part of a nonviolent protest at the White House to call attention to the need for immigration justice. And generally, my inclination is toward the social ethics of Martin Luther King Jr., who emphasized that vital insight that the ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, what's sometimes called a vicious cycle as opposed to a virtuous cycle. So it's a descending spiral begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding a deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. In that spirit, the nonviolent activist A.J. Musta famously said, "There is no way to peace. Peace is the way." In other words, that if you want that end of peace, that the ends and the means must be commensurate. The way to peace is peaceful means. But of course, at the same time that Martin was preaching peace, Malcolm X was preaching violence, or teaching that justice must be reached by any means necessary. To be fair, though, what he meant was that he was a realist. If racial justice could not be accomplished through nonviolence, that might be the ideal. But if nonviolence didn't work, violence was an option kept in the back. And some of you may remember some of those famous pictures of Black Panthers carrying guns at rallies, which is an interesting contrast to the Tea Partiers carrying, right? It's interesting to see how all that sort of compares in history. So we should also note that the early Nelson Mandela held violence as an option if nonviolent means were exhausted. Or to quote Theodore Parker, one of the two Secret Six who was a Unitarian minister, "Liberty is an end, and sometimes peace is not the means toward it." Keep in mind as well where we are historically. So John Brown's raid is happening in 1859. In 1859, you're a whole lot closer to 1776. And remember, these Unitarian ministers, they're in Boston. Lexington and Concord were the first shots of the Revolution, you know, using violence to create social change and bring freedom. They're a whole lot closer to 1776 than we are to them. So you think 1776 to 1859 is a much smaller gap than 1859 to 2014. So they really had that. They had, you know, grandparents that were in the Revolution, right? So that's part of where they're coming from. So when they think about how do we free the slaves, they have the American Revolution very much in mind. Another way of framing this debate is the old adage that one person's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. Certainly John Brown, operating on the cusp of, again, what became the U.S. Civil War, saw himself and his use of violence to fight the evil of slavery as on the side of truth and righteousness. Before he was sentenced to be executed, which he saw as his martyrdom, he said to the judge, "I believe that to have interfered as I have done in behalf of God's despised poor, I did no wrong but right. Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice and mingle my blood with the blood of my children and the blood of millions in this slave country whose rights have been disregarded by sick, cruel, and unjust enactments, I say, let it be done." And although history has shown that Brown was delusional in some disturbing ways and had some very serious character flaws, which I can go into at some future dates that he lied about and covered up about his history, and some really horrific things that he did in Kansas that he covered up prior to what happened in Virginia, I also take seriously Dr. King's criticism that we heard earlier of the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, "I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action," who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom. I take those criticisms from King very seriously. And say what you will about Brown and the Secret Six, and I certainly don't think the way they proceeded was perfect, but when pressed, they were not moderate, I think we can say. They chose a much more dangerous, radical, and risky path, for better or worse. One of the most helpful and challenging books I have read that confronts the issue of wrestling with whether one is playing the equivalent role in our own time of what Dr. King called the white moderate is contemporary Unitarian Universalist professor Sharon Welch's book, A Feminist Ethic of Risk. The passage that frankly haunts me from her book is as follows. She writes that it is easier to give up on long-term social change when one is comfortable in the present. When it is possible to have challenging work, excellent health care and housing, and access to the fine arts. When the good life is present or within reach for you, it is tempting to despair of it ever being in reach for others and resort merely to enjoying it for oneself and one's family. Becoming so easily discouraged is the privilege of those accustomed to too much power, accustomed to having needs met without negotiation and work, accustomed to having a political and economic system that, for the most part, responds to their needs. Responsibility is equated with action that is more likely to succeed, thus identifying responsibility with action that is, by definition, supportive of the status quo. With the benefit of hindsight, we can today see the ways in which the Secret Six were in many ways naive in supporting John Brown's raid on the Federal Armory at Harper's Ferry, which had almost no chance of succeeding. Indeed, Frederick Douglass, the famous African-American activist, told Brown that this was crazy. You know, he went to Douglass's home, met with him, and Douglass said, "I am not helping you with this. We agree on the desired end, but this is not the way forward." At the same time, one can argue that the Secret Six risked their comfort and privilege to support Brown's armed insurrection because they had come to believe that both nonviolent legislative means of ending slavery had shown they had no chance of succeeding. Keep in mind, the Fugitive Slave Act had been enacted, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and that the evil of human chattel slavery in the United States must be ended ultimately by any means necessary, including violence, if necessary. The historical consensus is that Brown's raid, even though it failed, did catalyze the movement towards civil war, causing Brown to be viewed as a martyr by many. In addition to the two Unitarian ministers who were part of the Secret Six, the most well-known Unitarian layman of the Secret Six was Samuel Gridley Howe, a graduate of Harvard Medical School who became famous for his groundbreaking efforts in educating the blind and deaf. Howe's wife, Julia Ward Howe, who is well-known for many reasons, including founding Mother's Day, which she originally intended through her Mother's Day proclamation to be a day of peace. It was about mothers getting together and saying, "War has killed too many mothers' sons and daughters, and we must stop war." That was what she wanted Mother's Day to be about. Somewhat ironically, given that later call for a Mother's Day of peace, Julia Ward Howe was also known and famous for writing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, whose lyrics were written to an earlier song, "John Brown's Body," written by Civil War soldiers. Some of the lyrics to that earlier song, "John Brown's Body," include the following, which I'll invite you to listen to momentarily. "Imagine, if you can, the original setting in which these words were sung by Union soldiers gathered around a campfire."
John Brown's body lies moldering in the grave. John's brown body lies a moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. John Brown died that the slaves might be free. John Brown died that the slaves might be free. John Brown died that the slaves might be free. His soul goes marching on.
Julia Ward Howe's version, set to the same tune, which traditionally was included in our Unitarian hymnals, it's not in this most recent version. It included these words. I'll invite you to listen just to three verses.
"Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. I can read his righteous sentence by the dim and flaring lamps. His day is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Christ was born across
Hallelujah.
The sea with a glory in his bosom that transfigures
Hallelujah.
You and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make
Hallelujah.
Men free
while
God is marching on.
It's a powerful song with moving and difficult lyrics. And I don't have an easy conclusion for us this morning. There's no simple resolution to the tension between waging war and making peace in Unitarian and Universalist history. Headlines remind us daily that the struggles of violent and nonviolent social change are as viscerally and existentially real today in Israel and Palestine, Syria and the Ukraine and other places around the world as they were historically here in the Civil War, World War I, and the Civil Rights Movement. Part of the tension from our perspective today is that the lyrics of John Brown's Body and the battle hymn of the Republic, and one of the reasons this song is no longer in our hymnal, is that they add a strong religious fervor and justification to the use of violence, equating God with only one side of the battle. But Mark Morrison Reed, who's the best contemporary African-American historian of Unitarian Universalist history, I was at a retreat with him recently, and he would actually argue for the inclusion of the Battle Hymn of the Republic in our hymnal, because to him, even if we don't always sing it or we introduce it before we sing it, that to him the exclusion of it is to cover up our history and to cover up the role that Unitarians and Universalists played in the abolitionist movement for racial justice. As an alternative perspective, I'll leave you for now with the final stanza of another song, this one by Bob Dylan. So now as I'm leaving, I'm weary as hell. The confusion I'm feeling ain't no tongue can tell. The words fill my head and they fall to the floor. If God's on our side, God'll stop the next war.